century BC, Indian civilization was already ancient. Perhaps 1500 years had passed since wandering Aryan tribes from Central Asia, entering the Indian subcontinent along the Indus River, had found a civilization already 1,000 years old, in which what I would call the defining features of the Hindu faith, practice of meditation and the worship of God as Shiva and the Divine Mother, seem to have already been established. The Aryans brought with them a social order presided over by priests or Brahmins, the trustees of ancient hymns, rituals and deities related to those of other lands, especially Persia, where Aryan tribes had spread. India seems to have dealt with this new religion as it has dealt with cultural imports ever since. It absorbed the new into the old. As a result, in even the earliest of the Indian scriptures, the Rig Veda, whose oldest hymns go back at least to 1500 BC, we find Aryan nature gods integrated with the loftiest conceptions of mysticism. There is no inconsistency in this integration, only a very early recognition that life's supreme reality is described in many ways. Truth is one, says a hymn of the Rig Veda. The wise call it by different names. From the beginning, then, two subcurrents ran through the broad river of Vedic faith. One, followed by the vast majority of people, is the social religion of the Vedas, with Brahmins in charge of preserving the ancient scriptures and presiding over a complex set of rituals. But another tradition, at least as ancient, teaches that beyond ritual and the mediation of priests, it is possible through the practice of spiritual disciplines to realize directly the divine ground of life. This ideal is sanctioned in Vedic religion as the human being's highest vocation. The opportunity is open to anyone to wrap up social obligations and retire to an ashram in the Himalayas or in the forests flanking the Ganges to learn from an illumined teacher how to realize God. This choice is often misunderstood as world weariness, and we know that even in those most ancient times, India had ascetics who tortured their bodies in the desire to free their spirit. But this is not India's classical tradition, and the typical ashram of the times is a retreat where students would live with an illumined teacher as part of his family, leading a life of outward simplicity in order to concentrate on inner growth. Sometimes graduates of these forest academies would go on to become teachers themselves, but it was at least as likely that they would return to society, disciplined in body and mind, to make a contribution to some secular field. Some, according to legend, became counselors of kings. One, Janaka, actually was a king. These men and women turned inward for the same reason that scientists and adventurers turn outward, not to run from life, but to master it. They went into the forests of the Ganges to find God, as a poet turns to poetry or a musician to music, because they loved life so intensely that nothing would do but to grasp it at the heart. They yearned to know what the human being is, what life is, what death means, and whether it can be conquered. Oral records of their discoveries began to be collected around 1000 BC, or even earlier, in fragments called the Upanishads. Individualistic in their expression, yet completely universal, these ecstatic documents belong to no particular religion, but to all mankind. They are not systematic philosophy. They're not philosophy at all. Each Upanishad contains the record of a darshana, literally something seen, a view not of the world, of everyday experience, but of the deep still realms beneath the sense world, accessible in deep meditation. The eye cannot see it. Mind cannot grasp it. The deathless self has neither caste nor race, neither eyes, nor ears, nor hands, nor feet. Sages say this self is infinite in the great.